Lighting the way with positive energy and love. HRNradio.com.
Live, journey into mind, heart, and soul. I'm Rabbi Wayne Dossick, inviting you to come on the journey. Join in the quest. Spirit Talk Live is our monthly forum for exploring the great questions of existence, for joining in the quest to find meaning and worth in life through intellectual inquiry and through sacred spirits. It is a worldwide conversation for spiritual seekers and for rational empiricists, for people of all religions and of no religion, of all faiths and of no faith, because here on Spirit Talk Live, nothing is sacred and everything is sacred. Well, welcome, welcome, welcome to this month's edition of Spirit Talk Live. We're so happy that you are here with us. We have an incredible and wonderful guest today. But first, I'd like to remind you about my newest book, The Real Name of God, Embracing the Full Essence of the Divine. You can find out about this book at the website www.God.com. There you can see a 7-minute video when I explain the ideas and the concepts in this book. And you can listen to all the chants that are in the book. As we used to say on the old South Side of Chicago, you can listen to them free for nothing. Or you can buy a hard copy CD to sing along with all the chants that are in the book. This is truly radical and revolutionary theology, and if only people would read it and listen, read the book and listen to the chants, it could change the world, because its theme is the same theme as this radio program: One God, One World, One People. Do check it out, www.godisanochi.com. And before we run out of time at the end, Ellen and I wish you a blessed and happy holiday season. This should be the beginning of a world that is consciously aware of oneness, so that we are not broken apart any further, but we come together closer and closer. So a blessed season to everyone, and prayers and blessings for harmony and peace. So I have to tell you that when I read this book that we are about to learn about, it was just, as they say, mind-blowing. The book is The Beautiful Possible. The author is Amy Gottlieb. It is one of the finest, most compelling books I've read in decades, and I immediately found her and asked her to be on the program so that you could learn from her as well. So it is a great pleasure to welcome from her home and offices in the Bronx, in the Riverdale section of New York, the author of The Beautiful Possible, Amy Gottlieb. This book is published by Harper, and my first, I think, 5 books were published by Harper. So we share the same publishing house, probably different departments, but nevertheless the same very fine publishing house. The Beautiful Possible, a novel by Amy Gottlieb, published by Harper. Amy, welcome to Spirit Talk Live.
Thank you so much, and thank you for that wonderful introduction. I'm delighted to be here.
All very, very well deserved. So, without giving away anything, tell us about the story of the book.
Okay, so The Beautiful Possible tells the story of a post-war braided love triangle. It's more of a braid than a triangle, between 3 people caught between worlds. Walter Westhaus is a spiritual nomad. He's a German Jew who fled Nazi Germany and spent the war years in India at the ashram of the Bengali Indian poet Tagore. The next person in the braid is Rosalie Karam, a free-spirited rabbi's wife, who is trapped between tradition and feminist longing. And the third character is Saul Karam, a conservative rabbi whose crisis of faith reveals and conceals the boundaries of his identity. And their lives are braided together throughout 70 years and transcends into the next generation.
So you just described Emily as an awakening, Rosalie, as an awakening feminist. Would you say as well, at least it seems to me, that she's an incredibly awakening spiritualist as opposed to her husband Saul, who's much more of a rationalist?
Absolutely. So, first of all, Rosalie's father was an iconoclastic Hasidic rabbi in Brooklyn. So he's a cross between a little bit of Zalman Schachter Shalomi and my late grandfather. So there's a lot of insight, there's a lot of universalism, and there's also a bit of impishness and quite a lot of love. And he raises Rosalie to ask questions beyond what seems to be the parameters of tradition. He teaches her the Mei HaShaloach, the writings of the Ishbitzer Rebbe, which were considered quite radical. And he asks her to really question her life and to demand as whatever she can to make her life into, quote-unquote, a sacred story. And for a young woman who's coming of age in the late 40s, early 50s, this is quite radical. And Rosalie also is brilliant, and she carries these questions through her life. Unfortunately, she lives at a time where women such as Rosalie didn't become spiritual leaders. They often married them. So she marries Saul Karam, who is becoming a conservative rabbi, and his love is for the text itself. He loves the Talmud. He loves really, really parsing obscurities and trying to put it all together for himself and for others. And his job is to become a pulpit rabbi and to lead a congregation in the suburbs. And as many people know, suburban congregational rabbis in the mid part of the 20th century had a bit of a challenge trying to make trying to create meaningful spiritual communities. So both Rosalie and Saul are caught in this predicament.
A couple reactions to what you just said. First of all, I would say that in addition to your grandfather and to Rav Zalman, I see a lot of Rav Shlomo, Rav Shlomo Karabach, because he was the in our generation, the greatest conveyor of the teachings of the Ishbitzer. Was that part of your thinking?
Not consciously, but he's definitely there.
Yeah.
But not consciously in terms of how the character of Rosalie's father developed. And then he became his own. Obviously, he became his own person. But those were the influences. But absolutely. You know, my understanding of the Ishbitzer came through learning from students of both Shlomo and Rav Zalman.
Yeah. Well, obviously they were both my big rabbis, but I much more associate Shlomo with the Ishbitzer than Rav Zalman. Although Rav Zalman referred to him now and then, but Rav Zalman had other bigger rabbis, I think, big rabbis that he referred to more often. Just a minor point. The second thing is, when Saul goes out to the, Saul and Rosalie go out to the suburbs, they were part of that generation of conservative rabbis. Those were my rabbis when I was a kid, the conservative rabbis of the 50s and early 60s, who really saved American Judaism from, for example, my father, Olam Shalom, could not be in the Orthodox Shul synagogue of his parents, and at the same time reform was way too reform for him, so we became part of the conservative movement, and those who couldn't be Orthodox and those who couldn't be reform, the conservative movement became the address of American Judaism, and those rabbis who most of whom had left their Orthodox backgrounds and in many cases alienated their families, they really came out and solved it, went to a suburb, built up a big synagogue, and really saved an entire generation of young people, including me and all my contemporaries, who through USY, Solomon Schechter Day Schools, and eventually, certainly Camp Ramah, well, eventually Solomon Schechter Day Schools, they were too late for me, but just saved an entire generation of American Jews. They're real heroes.
That's absolutely right. And I also grew up in a conservative synagogue, and it was similar. There was no way that my parents or any of our neighbors would belong to an Orthodox synagogue, and Reform was very foreign to us. So, you know, it was the default.
In the community in which I grew up,
our synagogue never became a thriving synagogue.
Uh-huh.
It always was trying to sort of find itself as a default community where we lived, which frankly made for a very interesting spiritual community in which to grow up.
Well, I grew up in a conservative synagogue around the University of Chicago, which was a changing neighborhood, and as we moved south, we kept coming back to Rosh Hatzedek for the Hebrew school, for the rabbi in particular. But at one point in the mid-50s up to the early 60s, we had probably 1,000 kids or more in the afternoon Hebrew school.
Wow, that's amazing.
And my wife grew up in Anaheim, California, Orange County, halfway between Los Angeles and San Diego, and there was nothing there Jewishly, literally nothing, until the aerospace industry came in, and she too grew up in a synagogue that just began there, and it was 1,000 kids in the Hebrew school at its height. Well, speaking of Southern California, a couple of your scenes take place in Escondido, which is 20 minutes from my house.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So how did you get to know Escondido, California from the Bronx?
So I went to an artist colony in Temecula called Dorland Mountain Arts Colony many years ago. And it's just a beautiful part of the world. So I ended up weaving it into the book. When I was there, I was working on an earlier novel that I never published, but the landscape seeped into my imagination.
Well, next time you come back, or if you come back for a refresher, you have to come and meet us.
Absolutely.
And I understand unpublished stuff. I have a whole pile of books that I've written that have never been published. So.
I think, not every book is meant to be published.
Yeah. All mine are, but... the life of a writer, eh?
It's challenging, and it's a great privilege as well.
It really is. So can you tell us about the title, The Beautiful Possible, and also, as a literary device, I was amazed that you put it on page 7. Usually when people have a title that doesn't immediately resonate, or they introduce the title finally by two-thirds of the way through the book or whatever, you introduce the title right away, but it's still an enigmatic title. So tell us about it.
So The Beautiful Possible refers to the unfolding story that always lies ahead. It's possible in that we don't know where it's going to go. We don't know how things will unfold. But there's always a striving to make something beautiful and whole. Can you hear me?
Yes, sure.
There was a buzz on the phone for a moment. So that's the basic essence of the title. And I use that phrase in three different ways throughout the novel. So one of them, as you mentioned, is very early in the novel. That's on page 7. And then there are two other instances in which it's mentioned, and each time it has a slightly different meaning. And ironically, this was not the original title of the book. And when I was looking for a title, I mined the text itself for the title, and there it was, three
times. Very interesting. Well, you use great literary devices, which is why your book is so brilliant, because not only the story is wonderful, but you are a fabulous writer. You are a fabulous writer. And one of the things that you do throughout the book is use the literary device, which in Hebrew we call Shela V'Tshuva, questions and answers. And usually it is used when scholars, rabbis, are looking to understand Jewish law. I have a question of Jewish law, and I get an answer from somebody. But you use it as a literary device for people just questioning their lives, what's going on in their lives, choices they need to make. How did you decide to use that kind of literary device, and how do you think it works in the book?
Well, it works in some ways. It introduces a poetic way of asking questions
right.
in the book. And it came about because early in the book, I play around with the way Saul and Walter are playful study partners, right? So they talk about the text in ways that are fun for them, which is what study partners tend to do. So I wanted them to actually use the same kinds of devices that the Talmudic rabbis were using as part of their own way of mining the text and playing with it and bringing them into it. And then once I had it, it opened itself up for all sorts of poetic and narrative possibilities for me. And I ended up weaving this as a constant motif throughout the book. And each one plays with the whole notion of question and answer in a very different way. But the common theme is that questions always lead to more questions, and the answers are open-ended. And that's, you know, one of the big motifs of the novel.
Yeah, I thought it was a very intimate way for people to relate to each other, almost like the language that develops between partners, lovers, husbands and wives, study partners in one way. So I thought you employed that as a literary device really brilliantly.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It was all, you know, everything that I did in the book was deliberate. And I've spent a lot of time in Jewish circles, and I've worked as an editor for rabbis for many, many years, but all along I've been a literary writer. So I'm always literary. What I'm learning from literature itself always comes first.
Well, you certainly take your place in the canon of literary authors.
Well, thank you so much.
Do you know, I don't know if the audience will care, except he's been on the program before. Do you know Thane Rosenbaum?
Sure.
Yeah. So he's like that as well. Must be a New York influence for all of you.
I don't know. Or you know, writers are always reading and learning, and it's pretty exciting.
So our listeners should remember Thane Rosenbaum, who wrote Golems of Gotham, and most recently How Sweet It Is. He was on the program talking about that. And Elijah Visible, a fabulous, fabulous author, and a really good guy as well. So a lot of the book is set in the seminary, and you name it. I mean, it's not just a literary device here. You talk about the Jewish Theological Seminary, 122nd and Broadway in New York. And you obviously know it very well because you know its basements and its warrens down there and the library. And how do you know the seminary so well?
So for 14 years, I worked as director of publications for the Rabbinical Assembly, which is the International Association of Conservative Rabbis.
Of which I'm a proud member.
Yes, that's how I got to know your name. And there's nothing like working in an institution for a long time to get to know its institutional memory and also to know its building. And I decided not to fictionalize it because it's a legendary place, and I didn't think it needed to be fictionalized. So the building itself is obviously, you know, a lot is made up. The objects that were in the attic weren't really the objects in the attic, but there was a lot that lent itself to my imagination.
Yeah. Probably those objects would have burned in the fire in the 60s, so those kinds of ancient texts.
Although I will say that I worked there after the fire, and there were lots of strange objects in the attic.
Well, dear friends, we're here on Spirit Talk Live with Amy
Gottlieb,
the author of The Beautiful Possible, an incredible novel published by Harper. And we have many more questions for her, and we will hear the author read her own work. You know, Holden Caulfield always wanted to know where the ducks go in winter, and could he meet the author? Well, you're meeting the author, and you'll hear her read from her own book. Amy Gottlieb, the author of The Beautiful Possible. This is Spirit Talk Live. I'm Rabbi Wayne Dussek, as always, inviting you to come on the journey. Join in the quest.
Music, information, and friends. HealthyLife.net.
We're back. This is Spirit Talk Live. I'm Rabbi Wayne Dussek, along with Amy Gottlieb, the magnificent author of the magnificent novel, The Beautiful Possible, published by Harper. So, Amy, spices play a big role in this book. And as a matter of fact, the three spices that you mention most often are turmeric, cardamom, and coriander. And so I have turmeric, cardamom, and coriander sitting on my desk right now to inspire me to ask the right questions. And why spices? Why these three spices? And do they represent anything in your thinking in the novel?
Sure. So the origin for the spices came from the Song of Songs. So there are a lot of motifs in this novel from the Song of Songs.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was working on this in the beginning stages, I was thinking of it as a midrash on the Song of Songs. So that's where, so there were different small motifs and larger motifs that come from that text. And that's exactly where the spices came from. And these three spices are Indian spices, and those were chosen because Walter, after he escapes Berlin, he makes his way to India, and he spends time in Bombay, and he works at a spice market, and that's where he begins to wake up to his life, to the possibilities of his life, and to being a feeling person who can move ahead after trauma. So the spices for him become significant as emblematic of a way to heighten his consciousness. So they're more than spices, they're also a bit of a drug. You know, he gets sort of hits from them and plays around with that. So I was able to use that throughout the book in all sorts of ways. And then later, there's, you know, the spices come back in a different way. And I don't want to give too much of a spoiler, but, you know, for the book to have been written, the person who writes the book, right, Maya, has to smell the spices and understand what these meant for her parents.
Maya being the daughter of Solid Rose.
Their daughter.
So the question is, in the beginning, and certainly in the beginning of the marriage, how does Sal not see the turmeric stains, if you will, on Rosalie's body?
So he's not really tuning into Rosalie at the beginning of their marriage, right? So if you look at that, it's a very awkward, they have a somewhat awkward connection, because early in the book, Sal, who has his own odd sexual connection with himself and others, he has some, you know, he's fairly repressed. He's also in love with Walter. And that's, you know, clear when they're study partners at the seminary. And then he rebuffs him. He turns from him because his feelings towards Walter are overwhelming. And then there he is with his wife, and he doesn't really notice her. He doesn't completely notice her physically, spiritually, or psychologically. And that's part of how the story works, right? So his blind spot toward his wife allows other possibilities to open up for his wife to find fulfillment with Walter, and in turn for Saul to keep Walter close to him.
And yet before the marriage, he yearned for her physically, and after the marriage, after the wedding, she was the one who wouldn't consummate the marriage.
That's right. That's right, because what happens between those two time periods is Walter.
Right.
And Walter changes.
Right. Right. So it's a fascinating story. It really is. It's a very, very passionate, very sensual, very, very sexual story. It was always thus, the lover's triangle. So interesting. So, dear friends out there, we'd like to ask Amy Gottlieb to read from her book so you hear the author and the intonations, because she knows what she wrote far better even than it comes out on the page. So this is the prologue to the book, which she will read for us. So from the prologue, which sets the tone of the entire book, The Beautiful Possible by Amy Gottlieb, here is Amy Gottlieb.
Okay, here's the prologue. When my mother and I would enter the paneled sanctuary on Shabbat mornings, my father would peer down from his rabbi's chair and bite his lip. It was a wink of recognition, barely a gesture. I would fold my hand in hers, and we would swing our arms in a proclamation of private joy. The congregants would turn toward the aisle, gaze at their sultry Rebbetzin in her wide-brimmed hat, and behold her as if she were a queen. My mother's body was a source of pleasure to me. The strawberry scent of her face cream, the delicate veins on the backs of her hands, the satiny texture of her summer Shabbat dresses. One dress was made of crisp white cotton, patterned with red bricks. The sleeves ended at her elbow. Huge flower-shaped buttons ran down the front. A thick patent leather belt cinched her waist. I would sit next to her in the front row and lay my cheek against the bricks that covered her upper arm. My father would read from the Torah and deliver his sermon, and I would twirl the buttons of my mother's dress as if they were radio dials, and I controlled the frequency. The synagogue stairwell was my first jungle gym, its parking lot my first hopscotch course. I was the congregant's flower child, their little pet. Come sit on my lap, Maya. Point out the words to me. Have a lollipop. Sing me a little song. As soon as I learned Hebrew, my father taught me how to move my fingers around a page of Talmud as if I were a blind person reading Braille. I once believed all the words of the Torah were true, just as I once assumed that my mother and father belonged to each other in the way of ordinary married people. I was Saul and Rosalie Kerem's late life consolation prize. Accident, miracle, and redemption rolled into the form of a lanky girl whose bangs reached her nose. Whenever my mother invited me to make a birthday wish, I would close my eyes and imagine things already present in this world, a white flower, an arched doorway, a footpath crossing a river. I lip-synced my favorite songs in front of a mirror, and when no one was watching, I would peek into the ancient books on my father's shelves, hungry for a phrase to swirl on my tongue and taste its meaning. At night, my parents would sit on the sofa in my father's study and listen to records. Fly me to the moon, sang Frank. Dance me to the end of love, sang Leonard. I say a little prayer, sang Diane. I would spy them studying the liner notes as if the lyrics were sacred texts, yet something about their marriage always eluded me. Our house was a palace of stories, the ancient ones in the books, the love stories in the songs, the secrets my mother whispered into the phone late at night. At times, I would drift off to sleep and imagine how all the stories were part of one great big book that hummed with sadness and longing. I was once content with my flower, my doorway, my footpath. What I had was more than enough. I did not know that I was also written into this great book, and that my parents were entangled in a web of desire that began long before I was born.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful, beautiful. And that sets the tone for the entire book. So you introduce the one character, and actually in the notes in the back, which are very, very helpful, it's a Harper device these days where the author is, like, gives an interview sort of talking about why I wrote this book and what does this mean and so on and so forth. Very, very enlightening. You said the one character whom you clearly base a fictional character after, but is really real, is Colette from Jerusalem. And when we come back, I'm going to ask you to tell our audience a little bit about Colette. We have many friends in common, you and I, who consider her one of their greatest teachers ever. And we'll find out about this mystical woman in the holy city of Jerusalem and how her character is played out in your novel. The Beautiful Possible, Amy Gottlieb. This is Spirit Talk Live. We'll be right back after these messages.
Radio your way. HealthyLife.net.
Back with Amy Gottlieb, the author of The Beautiful Possible. As soon as this program is over, run out and get this book. Makes a great Hanukkah present for everybody. Tell us a little bit. I mean, the people we know, and I didn't ask them if I could mention their names, but of course, they would be very, very proud if I did. The people that you and I, I'm sure, know in common, who were great students of Colette, Shiva Penner and Eve Ilson, who was, of course, married to Reb Zalman, Ellie Spitz, Chana Teferet Siegel, Carol Rose, Leah Novick, Rolinda Unwald, and, of course, Roger Kamenetz. These are all our buddies. I know them all. You probably know them all. They say their lives were totally changed from their encounters with Colette, a true mystic living in the Holy City. You create a character whom you call Sylvie, and you tell her that it is Madame Colette. So tell us more about the woman and the kind of mysticism she embodied and how she gave it over.
Okay, so I never met Madame Colette. So I'm a little younger than the cadre of people who actually were in her courtyard in the 60s, you know, from the 60s to the 80s. And so by the time I had been reading different accounts and different stories about her and her visualizations, she was already gone. So it was too late for her to meet her. It was too late for me to meet her. So all I had were things that I had read. But a lot of what I was reading was, you know, it followed a similar pattern, right? So she gave people visualizations that she called shocks. In the novel, I call them little astonishments. And they were visualizations that would, you know, allow people to shift something in a psychic and spiritual realm in a small way or a large way. And so I was really very intoxicated with this, but I didn't get to meet her. And but she lent herself to such a great character, and she really belonged in this book, partly because of the time period and partly because of what she represents. And at the end of the book, she becomes even more significant. I don't want to give away any spoilers, but in terms of the location of where Maya ends up, there's a connection yet again to Madame Sylvie. So, you know, she represents a different kind of spirituality, a spirituality that's much more personal, obviously very, very different from what one would experience in a congregational or institutional setting. And part of the conversation, in the larger conversation in my book, is the contrast between different kinds of spiritual experiences.
So I won't tell you what I think. I'll listen to you first, and then maybe I'll tell you what I think. The question of the age is, and you may have heard this in the introduction to this program, that this program is for spiritual seekers and rational empiricists, people of all religions, of no religion, of all faiths, and no faith. So, but that seems to be, in many, many ways, both in synagogues, and I taught at a Catholic university for 17 years, it's certainly in the church, the didactic tension between rational thought, and in our case, Jewish law, and spirituality. Now, this, you know, for us, it goes all the way back to the Hasidim and the Misnagdim in the 1800s, but that's the question now. We hear so many people say, well, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. So the question is, given all that you've written here, what in your opinion, is the pathway toward God and in the established institutions, where should the emphasis be to bring us to that pathway? See,
so,
I'm making you a theologian.
That's an interesting question. I would say in my novel, if there is a pathway towards God as expressed in the novel, it's through story. It's through the unfolding story. And again, that's the connection to the beautiful possible. And it's through narrative, right? So in some ways, we know God through experiencing God, through how our lives tell a story, through interpretation, which is also how we tell or narrate the stories of our lives, as flawed as that might be. And I think all of this is very connected to theology. So one of the things I learned through the process of writing this novel was a connection between writing, between fiction, and between theology. And that became a really exciting place to explore. So I was very interested in that. And in terms of the second part of your question, in terms of Jewish institutions, you know, I have to plead the fifth to leave that up to all of you, right? I mean, I'm not a rabbi, and I'm deliberately not a rabbi because I want to be free to work with narrative and story and lyric and see where it goes, right? So I don't really speak for Jewish community or Jewish institution. Obviously, I, you know, as a practicing Jew, I find my own home in places that are spiritually engaging and dynamic.
Well, 25 years ago, I gave up the big suburban pulpits and the big salaries and the prestige that went with them to create a little, in my living room, prayer group, which we call the Elijah Minyan. Elijah because, as you know, tradition has it that Elijah will be the one who announces the coming of the Messianic, the Messiah of the Messianic Age. And the entire Minyan is for putting God at the center and for using traditional prayer, what we would call traditional davening, powerful English, and joyous chanting, and Hasidic and Kabbalistic meditation to help people create a deep, personal, intimate relationship with God. We're very good at the communal relationship with God, at least we throw those words around from the suburban pulpits. but it doesn't help people who are, and this you emphasize this so much in the book. You have that section about Saul not knowing the lives of his people, and he tells Rosalie to start a mahjong group where she will get what's going on. And at some point, she praises him for eating scrambled eggs with a new widow in the diner for half the day. The goal is, unless there is a deep, personal, intimate, loving relationship with God, it all becomes just rote. And so that's, in many, many ways, that's what I've been doing. My last 3-4 books have been about that, to help people. That's my job, to help people create their own personal relationships with God. So we'll hear your reaction back, and we'll hear a little bit more of the book when we come back to our final section. I'm here with Amy Gottlieb, the author of The Beautiful Possible. As you can hear from our conversation, it's a stunning book, just stunning. And we'll wrap up, although we could talk about this book for the next 7 programs here on Spirit Talk Live. But we don't have that time, so we'll see what we can do in the last section. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Spirit Talk Live. I'm Rabbi Wayne Dossick with Amy Gottlieb, the author of The Beautiful Possible.
All positive talk with a mature edge. HealthyLife.net.
We're back. Spirit Talk Live. Rabbi Wayne Dossick with Amy Gottlieb, author of The Beautiful Possible. I want to make sure that we have enough time, so I want to ask you about another sort of literary device. On page 44 of the book, you refer to, or one of your characters refers to, the Shema Yisrael, which is known as the Declaration of Jewish Faith, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. I see it much more as a mantra to bring us in close connection with God. But you refer to it and teach it here as a haiku. Walter's teaching it. Did you come upon this yourself? Did you know it from before? It's brilliant.
So that actually, my chavruta and dear friend came up with that. And I don't know if she was the first one to ever come up with it, but it was certainly her insight. And so I'm grateful to her for that. And it works perfectly, right?
It does. It's brilliant.
It's completely something that Walter would have come up with, because he puts sort of these a priori texts that we don't necessarily always think about in a new way, and Walter puts it in a poetic context and gives it new meaning.
So another literary device that you employed was referring to gigantic events almost casually. So many, many of the things that happen in the book are dissected deeply in a number of pages. And then after his mother died here and my mother died there, then it's almost like a throwaway. Why did you use that literary device to pass so much time? And since those people were at least peripherally involved in the story, why did you give them not so much attention?
Okay,
and it happened not just on that death, but those deaths, but a couple of other places as well.
Sure. So this is the struggle of working with major characters and minor characters and dealing with a huge expanse of time. So one of the challenges that fiction writers have, particularly novelists, is the problem of sort of getting people in and out of rooms and getting people through their lives, and a lot that happens. And if I created all these scenes for everything to unfold, this would have been an 800-page book, and it would have been insufferable.
I would have loved reading every page.
So part of what you need to do is work in shorthand. That's what writers do.
Got it. Very good.
You know, there, and I also want to say there's a lot of shorthand in the Bible, right?
Sure.
So keep in mind, Maya is the narrator of this novel, Maya is herself a young rabbi, so she studied text. And so she's fluent in the shorthand of, in different ways of telling a story, where there's going to be shorthand, and at other times there's going to be an interiority to go into a character's consciousness.
Sure. And all of that, which is, and it happened after these things, so it's a big hunk of time. You have no idea how long. Yeah.
Right.
It's very interesting. Yeah, so Maya, the daughter, becomes a rabbi, but a far different rabbi from her father, yet rooted in her father's teachings. So how did you create that kind of, how and why did you create that kind of character? Or that kind of character? Maya's been with us all along, but how did you create and why did you create her in that kind of mode?
So she's a natural product of these three parents, right? Their sensibilities, their tensions, their struggles, their time in history, and also the tremendous pain that that each of them experienced in their lives. So she is inheriting their story. When I started out writing the novel, at the very beginning, Maya didn't exist. Everything started with the character of Walter. Mm-hmm. And one character led to another to mm-hmm. another. When I had this this daughter who grew up to be a rabbi, that's when the novel all came together. And then when I finished the novel and became aware of the fact that she was its narrator, I had to go through it again several times to make sure every word, including the epigraphs, were hers, that they were something she would have written through her own sensibility.
I'm looking for the epigraph for my family. Very interesting. The epigraph to which Amy just referred is "For My Family." Very interesting.
Right, so, right. But there, no. Well, that's a dedication, but that's mine.
Okay.
The dedication
so
is
the
mine.
The epigraph
before each section. There's Ecclesiastes Rabba. There's one from Tagore, and there's one from Muriel Rukeyser. And I spent a long time obsessing over which ones Maya would choose, because I had a lot of choices.
Okay, it looks like I'm missing it here. I see the introduction to the first chapter.
Right, so part two, so the first one is part one, is from Ecclesiastes Rabbah.
Which Elie Wiesel Shalom used as the title of his biography. The sea is never
right.
the streams flow into the sea.
Right. All the streams flow into the sea.
Right.
The wisdom of a person comes from the heart, yet the sea is never full, but the heart can never be filled. And later in the book, Maya does say that she's, quote unquote, an Ecclesiastes girl. She really is.
Right.
And then the second text is from Tagore, which is part two, and he says, "The small truth has words that are clear. The great truth has great silence."
Right. Well, I have to tell you, you have created characters who will live at least in my mind and heart for a very, very long time. I've written a play which has not been produced, and I've written a little children's story which has not been published, and I know those characters as well as I know my own children. And they just live with me. When I refer to Liz the Wiz, who's a young lesbian nun in my play, my wife, the people who know the play, we all know her. We all know her well, and she's part of our lives. Well, Walter and Rosalie and Sal and Maya will be in my life for a very long time. And actually, I was not that familiar with Tagore, but I've gotten two of his books, one of prayers and one of an anthology of his work. And you've led me to a whole new learning that I will, I'm sure, incorporate from this Indian philosopher. So thank you for that. And thank you for creating these characters in this book. Amy Gottlieb, it's wonderful. I'm a big fan. So we'll be waiting for your next novel.
Well, thank you so much.
And I hope
and
that one of these days we get to meet different coasts. But
I'm quite honored.
And if next time I'm in the Bronx, I'll take you to Liebman's Deli. How's that?
That sounds great.
Great. So this is Amy Gottlieb. Go out and get the book, folks. It's really a very, very fine book. So many thanks to Amy, and many thanks, as always, to the great folks at HealthyLife.net, the visionary founder, Linda McKenzie, and the brilliant producer, Jay Cruz, for having us as part of the HealthyLife.net family. Thanks also to Doc Collins, who plays our theme song every week. Amy, you might have noticed it was Hayom, 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 all jazzed up. And thanks to our sponsors, whose names you will hear soon, who make it possible for Spirit Talk Live to be on the air. Next month, it's January 18th, third Wednesday of the month, and our good friend Rabbi Phil Grobarth will be here again with his newest novel called Silwan, exploring the clashing narratives of Jerusalem Jews and Muslims while probing the darker regions of the soul with a good love story thrown in. So Rabbi Phil has been here before. He'll be here again. So until then, friends, again, our best wishes and blessings for this holiday season and for a new year where the curses of the old year end and the blessings of the new year begin. So until we meet again here on Wednesday, January 18th, be good and do good, be sweet and be holy. Tune your consciousness, your awareness to oneness consciousness, for in oneness consciousness you are sourced to strive for the recognition and the reality of one God, one world, one people, the power and the promise of Eden on earth once again. That is why we invite you this month and every month to come on the journey, join in the quest. I'm Rabbi Wayne Dussek. This is Spirit Talk Live. Until next time, Shalom, Salam, Pax, Peace.